Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Thank you, Scott, and welcome to The Exchange. I'm Deirdre Bosa, and we have a very big hour on deck for you. There's Disney shareholder meeting that is just kicking off. The battle over the boardroom, that's about to be decided, and we will bring you all of the twists, the turns, the final tally when it is in, and of course, what the results mean for Disney's future. Plus, we've got Alphabet CEO Sundar Pichai speaking this hour. We are monitoring that event for any stock-moving headlines. And then Greenlight Capital's David Einhorn takes the stage live at the Sohn Investment Conference. You just heard Scott Wapner. He will give his best idea. You will see it right here. We begin with today's Marcus. Dom Chu has those numbers over at the Telestrator. Dom, good news is good news after
good
those
news,
ADP numbers?
Maybe some good news over here, Deirdre. So take a look at this because the markets are green across the board for all the major indices. The Dow Industrial is currently up just about 0.2%. 39,229 the last trade there. It's modest, but it's green. The S&P 500's at 5223, up about 18 points, one-third of 1% gains there, tilting towards the higher levels of the session. We were up 23 points at the intraday highs and down 11 points at the low. So there's your range in context for the S&P. The NASDAQ Composite, the tech-heavier index, up one-half of 1%, pacing the advance. 16,322 for the NASDAQ Composite trade, up about 82 points. One of the key stocks in focus helping to some of that tech upside is a bounce back that we're seeing in Tesla stock. It's up about two-thirds of 1% right now, $168 and change. Remember, trying to bounce back from those disappointing delivery and product production numbers from yesterday. A number of analysts out there with some negative commentary today, even some price target cuts. Nonetheless, shrugging that off, you can see those shares trying to get some kind of footing here just above that $165 mark. We'll keep an eye on Tesla. The other thing to watch is another record in gold prices. COMEX gold, 2313. We had 2316 earlier in the session, so we'll put a star right up here, another record high. This is going to be, if it does finish positive, the seventh straight day worth of gains for COMEX gold. So again, watch those precious metals. It seems to be that big momentum trade for right now. And then speaking of momentum, we've lost a little bit so far in terms of yields right now, but the 10-year note yields at 4.36%. We got as high as 4.43, almost at one point today. That would put you again at the highest levels going all the way back to roughly November 27th of this past year. So interest rates, a big focus there as well. We'll see whether or not there's stabilization there and whether or not equity valuations might be able to find some solid footing as well. I'll send things back over to you, Dee.
And equity is a little more resilient today. Dom, thanks very much. The other big speaker today, that's Fed Chair Powell, who just wrapped up his speech at a Stanford event. He emphasized the need for more evidence that inflation is easing before cutting rates, but what will higher for longer mean for the economy and consumers? We're going to talk all about it with Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics. We've also got Ted Rossman, senior industry analyst at Bankrate, on set with me. But let's start with CNBC senior economics reporter Steve Leisman. Steve, what do we hear? Not a whole lot new. Markets are holding on to their gains, largely unchanged.
Yeah, they seem to be. Powell saying in a speech today that if the economy evolves as expected, Deirdre, it will be appropriate to lower rates at some point this year. But he did introduce some doubt, I'd say, as to the amount and timing, saying about inflation, here's a few bullet points, that it's come down significantly, but it's still above target. The job of reducing inflation to 2%, quote, is not yet done. And he still needs greater confidence in those inflation numbers and its trajectory in order to cut interest rates. Speaking at the Stanford Graduate School of Business, Powell said recent reports on jobs and inflation have indeed come in higher than expected, but have not, quote, materially changed the overall picture, and that is of declining inflation. Still, he said it wasn't clear whether the recent firmer inflation reports were just bumps along the road towards that 2% inflation or start of something a little bit more worrisome. So what happened? The probability of a June hike did drift a bit higher, as in more of a chance of a cut, now trading at 61%. Earlier this week, it happened in the low 50s, a few points higher than it's been with greater confidence of a cut in the market, though. You can see there for the July and the September meetings. Powell said there could still be inflation reduction, coming from improved supply chains. And he said immigration had helped the economy grow without inflation by providing more labor supply. And he said on the big question on the economy, the jury's still out on whether the recent productivity surge is part of a longer term trend or just a temporary spike. And Deirdre, as you know, nothing matters more than the answer to that question. And nothing is more uncertain than the answer to that question.
Steve, well laid out. Thank you very much. Stick around. Let's bring in Mark Zandi and Ted Rossman. Ted, thanks for being on set with me. Mark, let's start with you. Anything new that sticks out to you in what Powell said? As Steve noted, those expectations for a June hike have ticked slightly higher.
Well, he stuck to script. He's still beating the drum that he's got time because the economy is strong and inflation's still above target. I think the key words for me in the speech was they're looking at this meeting by meeting. So it feels like he's saying, look, you know, every meeting is live. We could make a change at the next meeting or the one after that. So it feels, you know, like a rate cut is coming. You know, he did mention January, February inflation data. I think that's really critical. The inflation data is really critical here. Jobs less important at this point. It's all about inflation. And we got to make sure that, the bump in January, February inflation was just, you know, measurement, seasonal adjustment, which I think it is. So we'll get better inflation numbers, but we've got to see that. And once they do see it, I think we'll get a cut.
Ted, break down the consumer impact. What matters more for them, a looser policy or a stronger economy?
I think people right now are looking for a stronger economy and actually feeling that in the form of lower inflation, basically, because right now, by many measures, we have a strong economy. I mean, we have strong GDP growth. We have the lowest stretch below 4% unemployment since the 1960s. But you say a lot of this to people and they say, well, I don't feel it. You know, like I don't feel that secure in my job or my costs are up or I'm not getting ahead. So I think that whole sentiment versus reality is really important. Depends where you are on the spectrum, too. I mean, if you have credit card debt, those rates and balances have never been higher. If you're a homeowner, that's good, but you're probably not in the mood to move. You don't want to trade your 3 or 4% rate for a 7% rate, and plus the house is going to cost more. It's especially hard for young people looking to enter the housing market and pay down debt.
Right. We're going to talk more about the housing market. But, Steve, I want to come back to you on this matter of inflation. And you mentioned that Powell said that there was not a material change. But what about the move that we've been talking about, especially this week, in commodities? Price of oil back near $90. Is that going to trickle through and make those numbers especially stickier?
That's a great point. I'm becoming a little concerned about what the March inflation report is going to say when we get it later this month. You've had oil prices higher. You've had commodity prices higher. And you've had, I've been following this Cleveland Fed nowcasting on inflation. It remains kind of sticky. So I don't know that I'm confident we're going to get the relief that everybody wants from those January, February numbers. We talked to Bostic this morning. He said he's settling in for a slower progress. I was looking earlier at the movement in inflation over the past 3 months. It's only come down 16 basis points since December. And in the months before that, it came down 44 basis points. So it has slowed. Right. Loretta Mester said she's not surprised by the slowing of inflation progress because she had forecast it. So we're all going to have to, I think, take a deep breath and maybe just be a little bit more patient, hope that inflation is moving in the right direction, and not be frustrated that it's not moving faster, because I think it might be that the easy part's been done and now we have to battle a few headwinds in commodities and other things. Okay. And it'll just be, you know, basis points now, not say tenths of a point as it was before.
Right. Okay, well said. Stick around, everyone. We've got more data on how higher rates are impacting home buyers, as Ted alluded to. Diana Olick is here with the latest. Diana, maybe you could pick up on what Ted was saying for especially first-time home buyers. This is
tough. I mean, it's definitely rough out there, and we see it in the mortgage applications to purchase a home, which dropped again last week. They're now 13% lower than they were a year ago and 47% below where they were pre-pandemic in 2019. Much of that is due to today's higher interest rates, but it's also because a larger share of buyers are choosing not to use a mortgage. All cash made up 33% of existing home sales in February, up from 28% in February of last year, and that's the highest level in a decade. Not only does cash make buyers more competitive in a tight market, but it also saves them money over mortgage-dependent buyers. Both the convenience and certainty of all cash offers appeals to sellers so much that they're willing to take 10% less money if that money comes in cash. And this is according to a new study just released from UC San Diego. The study also found that about 10% of sales transactions fail when the buyer is paying with a mortgage. And that's because the lender needs to approve the loan based on appraisal and inspection, either or both of which can fall through. Sellers just don't want to take that risk. Now, of course, it's hard to get enough cash to buy a home. So what some buyers are doing now is either borrowing money from family or friends for the initial purchase and then taking out a mortgage to pay them back once the deal is done. Some are also doing what's called proof of cash, where they reserve the right to get financing prior to closing, but they show the seller that they do have the cash if it ends up being necessary. So it's a rough market out there, Deirdre.
Yeah, you just painted a pretty rough picture. Diana, stick around. Ted, what's your reaction to that? I mean, we kind of know this. This is the trajectory that we've seen. All cash would be nice. Leaning on family or friends would be nice as well. But what if those aren't options?
Yeah, I think the key here is that about 80% of current homeowners have a rate below 5%.
Right.
And we're not going back there anytime soon. We've come down a little bit. I mean, last fall, the 30-year fixed briefly hit 8% for the first time in about 20 years. Now we're at about 7%. We still think by the end of the year, we could be around 6%. That starts to open things up. I think maybe a medium or longer term goal is more 5%, 5.5%. Look, we're not going back to 3% or 4% anytime
right.
soon, but I think 5% or 6% gets people talking a little bit more about selling or buying than right now in the 7s.
Diana, does that line up with what you're seeing?
Well, I'll take you one up on that. It's actually 90% of mortgage holders have rates below 6%. So you really have to give them incentive to want to sell and to move up. And, you know, a story we were talking about yesterday is just how much more today it would take to buy the home you currently live in with today's
yeah.
rates. And that's actually 60% more than to buy the home that you're just in right now. And it's well over 130% to buy a home that's just 25% more expensive. So in order to get buyers to move up, which traditionally is what frees up the market and gets more supply out there, you're really going to have rates, I think, more in the 5% range. I don't think 6% is going to get you there. But really, we also just need more supply and we need the builders to do
but
that.
Diana,
but that's a whole nother story.
Yeah, jump in, Steve.
Diana, I have a question, which is, are there more buyers or sellers on the sidelines because of these high rates? Ted was talking earlier about the idea that not everybody wants to sell their home right now. Let's say they could move. Would that bring enough supply on the market? And I'll just add as a footnote, I would love to see the nation address this housing shortage problem in a way that essentially takes the onus off of monetary policy so that we could fix housing and you could have monetary policy doing its thing that it needs to do. But I just want to know, are there more buyers or sellers on the sidelines?
You can't separate monetary policy when that's how we finance homes. But really,
no,
you just need the you need to give more incentives to the builders. But to your question, are there more buyers or are there more sellers potential on either side? And we have no way of knowing how many people are thinking about selling their home. But I mean, I can tell you right now, I probably would have sold my home if rates were back where they were now. Empty nesters out there, you could look at the number of, you know, people in their 50s plus on up who are generally the move down buyers or the sellers. There is very, very strong demand. I will say millennials just took over yeah. as the biggest home buyers out there from the baby boomers who had been number one in the market. Now millennials, which are a huge cohort, have taken over as the number one home buyers out there. So there are a lot of buyers out there. How many sellers? Hard to say.
Well, and on that note, Ted, I wonder if you could talk about sort of the trade-off between buying and renting in this moment.
You know, people give renting a bad name, right? Everybody says renting is throwing your money away. I don't necessarily subscribe to that. I think there are some advantages in terms of mobility, like being able to move for another job opportunity or for lifestyle reasons. You're not on the hook directly for repairs and
right.
maintenance and taxes and things like that. Now, I get some of that's baked in. My advice to younger people would be, yeah, if you want to buy, that's a good goal, but don't rush into it. I mean, you don't want to do it before you're ready, and then you put so much money into this house, and it becomes something that holds you back financially.
Right. Do we still have Mark? I want to ask you, Mark, about Powell's comments on productivity shifting a little bit. And he said, I think just recently, that AI should increase productivity. Does that mean that this is more sustainable? How does that sort of change the economics of it in the job market that we could see going forward?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think we have seen a boost in productivity growth over the past year. Prior to this past year, going back prior to the pandemic, underlying productivity growth was about 1.5%. In the last year, it's over two. I don't think that's AI. In fact, that's not going to really show up on the scene until probably the second half of this decade, because it just takes a long time for that technologies like that to really become imbued in business practices. And really, it is only when new businesses form and optimize around the new technology that the productivity gains are really reaped. So this is going to take some time. My sense is this boost in productivity might be more temporary, related to all the quitting that people did back a couple, 3 years ago. Remember the very high rates of quits? Those folks, moved to jobs that are better suited to their skills and talents and education. It took them a little time to get up the learning curve, but they're up the learning curve, and that gives you a nice pop to productivity growth. I'm speculating here, but to Steve's point, it's very difficult to know what's driving productivity gains. But I sense what we're seeing now is more temporary than fundamental. The fundamental gains are coming, later in the decade.
Well, Steve, where I sit, obviously in Silicon Valley, usually there's a lot of talk about productivity, and you're even seeing hiring and workforces really starting to reflect that. Is it possible that some of those productivity gains are not showing up in the economic data we look at?
Yeah, well, Deirdre, first of all, it's good to get you out of Silicon Valley, where those guys are going to change the world every day for the better until, of course, they cash in with their, level B financing. So good to get you out of there and get a little reality check. Look, I'm a little more optimistic than Mark is on the productivity story. I think there were changes that were foisted on us, I guess, as a result of the pandemic. That when we find a productivity change that's positive, we don't lose it. It doesn't necessarily increase productivity all the time, but I think this AI stuff is yet to come. It may be even dragging on productivity right now. I think some of the work from home stuff could be adding to productivity. So I'm a little more optimistic about that. And I don't think Powell has the luxury of always being agnostic about it. I'm reminded back in 1996 when Greenspan made a very important call to not raise interest rates, because he did make a call amid the uncertainty about productivity. He was right about that. He kept the economy from having to suffer through higher interest rates than it otherwise would. And at some point, Powell or the next Fed chair is going to have to make a call on productivity, and it will have an impact on monetary policy.
Hey, Deirdre, really quick, what really matters now isn't productivity growth, it's labor force growth. I mean, that's extraordinary. And that goes back to Powell mentioned participation, but really, really much more important than that is the surge in foreign immigration. And that's why we've been able to grow so fast and generate so many jobs. And still wage growth is moderating, inflation is coming in. So the real story here isn't the productivity gains are nice, and maybe Steve's right. I'm not gonna debate it, but it's really about labor force growth. That has more legs.
On that note, that better than expected ADP number led Goldman to actually up its forecast for this Friday's jobs report. Steve, do you see that as in line with what you're thinking?
Yeah. Yeah. Let me just point out that this labor force growth is great, but Diana better figure out a place for all these people to live if we're going to have this labor
exactly.
force growth.
Yeah. Rental apartments, lots of supply.
I do think that we're going to have stronger payroll growth. It's going to remain strong. A great story in the journal today about immigration, something we've been talking about for a while here. And that does seem to have created an upward shift. Look, you cannot have 100,000 ghosts filling jobs. There has to be actual bodies in those jobs. And it appears as if we're finding actual people for the payroll jobs that are out there. It's been too consistent and too high for too long. And it doesn't appear to be inflationary at this point. And what's really interesting, Deirdre, and again, from your neck of the woods, still lots of talk about the inability to find workers, even at the higher rates that are out there. I am not sure, and I get some hate mail from some small business owners who I know it does affect, but I'm not sure that these minimum wage increases have these huge effects. I think so much of the working population is above that minimum wage that it has only a de minimis impact.
Well, and something that I see down there, too, is you called it ghost jobs. There's also robot jobs, right? A lot of the jobs are being automated or outsourced to generative AI. Last word for you, Mark. You're trying to get it.
Yeah, I was just going to say, we ignored the second part of Powell's speech, which is really important. I mean, he was saying, look, the Fed is independent. This is really critical. Yeah. And he's speaking to the election process. So, he felt it necessary to have this talk with us about Fed independence. And I think that's really something we should take to heart. It's really critical.
Okay, great point to end on. Gentlemen, Diana, thank you very much. Good discussion. Coming up, we are just moments away from David Einhorn's presentation at the Sohn Conference. We will bring you that to you live when it happens. Plus, we've still got Disney's boardroom battle. It is, as we're talking, nearing an end. Today's shareholder meeting is kicking off. We'll bring you the results, the implications for investors, and, of course, what it all means for the future of Disney. As we head to break, here's a look at markets rebounding after the Dow and S&P posted their worst day in nearly a month. That was yesterday. Today, the 10-year touching its highest level, though, since November. The exchange is right back after this.
This is The Exchange on CNBC.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you. Like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.
The bitter battle over Disney's boardroom is about to be decided as shareholders vote whether the company's board deserves another year together or if candidates nominated by activist investors, including Trian Partners, Nelson Peltz, should replace certain directors. The shareholder meeting is underway right now while we wait for the results. Let's take a quick look back at this bitter back and forth and how we got to this moment.
If there is a shareholder of Disney that's happy with what's going on, that guy has been short the stock.
I feel great about where the company is today and where I believe we'll be able to take it.
We will be watching, we will be rooting, and the proxy fight is over.
In some cases, the challenges are greater than I had anticipated.
They promised they were going to improve things. I took them at their word. Things got worse.
A lot of this fight seems to be looking backwards. I'm more interested in why I joined the board is looking forwards.
By every conceivable financial measure, the company is down. I don't know how a board can allow that to happen.
I have not spoken to Mr. Peltz in a while. I have no plans to speak to him.
I am not betting on putting somebody in the boardroom that could potentially be highly disruptive and change the future course of the Walt Disney Company.
We're not going to lose, okay? Let's get that straight.
And we actually have some breaking news from our own David Faber. Let's get to him right now.
They lost. Sorry, Nelson. In fact, the entire board of Disney has been reelected by what they're calling a substantial margin. That just called out by General Counsel Horacio Gutierrez at the annual meeting of the company. So all 12 Disney directors have been reelected. Obviously, it is a victory for Disney, a defeat for Trian, which had been seeking two seats on the board of directors. They haven't gone through numbers as of yet, but there are some that I can provide via sources in terms of Deirdre, overall votes and how many were allocated to various directors. First of all, roughly, I'm told, 70 or so percent, perhaps a bit more than that, voted. So roughly 70% of the outstanding shares were voted. And of those, for example, 94% of the votes or those shares voted were voted in favor of Bob Iger, the company's CEO. The universal proxy, it's different than what we used to see, you know, sort of more like an election it used to be. Basically, it's just the top 12 vote getters are on the board. And in this case, they were all Disney directors. Peltz was targeting Mary Elena Lagomasino, who goes by Mel. Sources tell me she received 63% of the votes that were voted, the shares that were voted, and Peltz received 31%. So she more than doubled his total. Obviously, defeat is not something that Tryon has seen that often in its proxy fights. The last one that I can recall was when they lost in DuPont. Of course, they came back not that long after and declared victory when Ellen Coleman left the company. But in that case, the margin of victory was far, far closer for DuPont than is the case here. Again, Iger gets 94%. And there's sort of the important one because, again, Pulse was challenging for that particular seat, saying, hey, vote the first 10 and then vote me and vote Jay Rasullo. And he was going after Laga Messino. He didn't win. She got 63%, 31% for Peltz. And finally, you know, retail we've talked about because they do comprise a fairly substantial number of the overall shares. But my understanding is here they didn't show up that much. 7 or 8% of the total vote was retail shareholders. Of those retail shareholders who voted, D, again, numbers I'm hearing are as many as 75% went with management or with all the Disney directors. So a significant victory for Disney over Tryon.
It sounds like a landslide, David. I mean, 94% of votes were in favor of Iger. Did we expect it to be that big of a gap?
Well, you know, it wasn't like Peltz was challenging Iger and saying it's either him or me. So the votes he didn't get were withheld, but that's a significant number saying, yes, hello, we're happy with your performance. I think, you know, the key one, though, really is the lady at the bottom there, Maria Elena Laga Messino, who goes by Mel. The fact that she more than doubled Peltz's number, at least in these numbers that I'm getting right now. So, again, that, you know, it's over. Over and done with, and they move on. I move on to go to Los Angeles so I can sit down with Bob Iger tomorrow morning.
Hopefully
get there.
Can't wait for that. That'll be a good one. You know, David, you say we all get to move on, but you also said that Nelson Peltz isn't used to this kind of defeat. And I remember when he called in to your show live and spoke to you and Jim and Carl and said that, you know, he was in favor that Bob Iger was successfully turning the company around only to go back again. Is this truly over or is there more that Nelson Peltz could do here? Could he come back?
It's hard to imagine he could come back after losing a proxy fight and losing it definitively. And we should point out we've got a statement from Tryon saying they're disappointed with the outcome. They greatly appreciate all the support and dialogue they've had with Disney stakeholders and proud of the impact they've had in refocusing, they say, the company on value creation and good governance. And to your point, of course, they had engaged with the company right after Iger had come back. It was brief in terms of how long that fight lasted, because to your point, it was when I interviewed Iger last February, I believe it was, and then Peltz literally followed up minutes later by saying, we're done. But we're going to hang around and watch, and then only to come back, of course.
Yeah.
This was a much more bitter and hard-fought struggle, as you well know, Dee. But Disney ends up victorious.
Hard-fought and dramatic. David Faber, thank you very much. We will be watching very closely tomorrow. So David will be talking exclusively with Disney CEO Bob Iger tomorrow at 9 a.m. Eastern on Squawk on the Street. You definitely don't want to miss that. Joining me now to discuss is CNBC.com reporter Alex Sherman and Disney shareholder Nancy Tengler. Nancy, let's get to you first. You said it didn't really matter because Nelson Peltz was an accelerant. Is this over one and two? Are you satisfied with the results?
Yeah, I mean, I actually think, Deirdre, that the shareholders won in this whole transaction. I mean, you couldn't have picked a better central casting villain versus, you know, CEO with Bob Iger, very measured and always calm and presentable, and Nelson, you know, kind of throwing darts. But the fact is the stock's up 35% year to date, as many have pointed out, and about 50% since Tryon got involved. So, you know, they control $3.5 billion. They spent $25 million. I think it was a victory for them, and I think it was a victory for Disney shareholders. And so let's move forward with the succession planning, because I think that's really what is bothering shareholders at the core.
Alex Sherman, let me turn to you. Does Bob Iger and his team get to breathe a little bit now, or is the pressure still on to perform? I mean, Nelson Peltz wasn't the only activist circling.
Yeah, what fun we all had, right? I mean, Tryon wins, Ike Perlmutter wins. The Disney board wins. Like, this was just a blast for everybody. No, look, there's some real concerns with Disney. And the main argument that Nelson Peltz had to join the board was that Disney has flubbed succession for years now. And Disney has retooled its board a little bit. James Gorman is on now, Jeremy DeRoe. So they have a couple new board members. And I think more than anything, they have sort of an eyes wide open approach that they need to get succession right. And in fact, that's kind of why Bob Iger came back in many ways. It wasn't only to sort of re-steer Disney's strategy and culture, but also to make up for the fact that he picked Bob Chapek as CEO. Yeah. That didn't work. And now he and the board need to get back to work and do it right this time, which will be very meaningful for Bob Iger's legacy. So that's really where the focus is now. It's got to be, and we've heard it on our air, that right. Disney is doing a robust succession process. I just reported on Monday, you know, Dana Walden, an internal candidate for that job. There are several others, Jimmy Pitaro, Josh D'Amaro, Alan Bergman. Maybe there are some external candidates we don't even know about. But over the next few months here, certainly the investment world mm-hmm. is going to be focused on, okay, who is it that's going to be taking over for Bob Iger? And what is that transition process going to look like?
Right. And Nancy, talk about those succession plans. Are you pleased with how they're progressing? Alex just named a bunch of internal names. Are any of them equipped? I know that Disney put out this statement that they're going through a rigorous preparation process. You know what, Nancy? Hold that thought. I'm going to come back to you on this. Let's get over to David Einhorn at the Sohn Conference.
However, value investing and the value investing industry are two different things. The value investing industry is the thousands of people that used to be employed to analyze and pick stocks by trying to figure out which ones were undervalued. Trillions moving from active management to passive have caused these people to be fired, and they're not coming back. This is what I mean by the value investing industry is dead. The cartoon says, good news, remember all those growth stocks I sold you? They are now value stocks. With all these unemployed people and their AUM gone, it's actually a great time to be a value investor. There's much less competition. There are cheap stocks that are just much cheaper than they would otherwise be if there were lots of professionals with capital to deploy trying to identify them. I will talk about one of those in a couple of minutes. When I started in this business, everyone said Warren Buffett benefited by starting his investment business when few people even read annual reports and few were good at valuing stocks. It was a shame that there was so much competition for me. There were thousands of experienced professionals trying to do the same thing. Well, guess what? That's how it feels right now. For the few of us who are left, it's a great time to be a value investor. There is so little competition that the opportunities to buy fine companies with double-digit cash-on-cash returns are more abundant than at any time in my career other than at the bottom of a bear market. This may be how Mr. Buffett felt in the 1950s. So here's an example I'll share with you today. The cartoon says, Mrs. Rothman, will any of this be relevant once AI takes over? We find ourselves asking the same thing. I know everyone is talking about AI, and the title of my talk today is Solve AI. At Greenlight, we have always thought of ourselves as being flexible investors, willing to learn new things. AI has been the rage for the last year, and we have found a great idea. Our idea today is Solve AI, a European company that most of you have never heard of. I'm very excited to tell you about it. It's most commonly known as Salve, whose motto is mastering the elements essential to our world. Salve is an essential chemical company that holds the number one position across all of its markets. Everyone wants a lesson in computer science. Instead, today we will study chemistry. I'm sure that thought excites all of you. Who besides my dad had chemistry as his favorite class? All right, so first chemistry joke of the day. Do you know why you can never trust an atom? They make up literally everything. Salve is a 160-year-old Belgian enterprise that trades under the ticker SOLB in Belgium. The company just went through a corporate restructuring. The old Salve was a chemical conglomerate that in December spun off its specialty chemicals business into a new company called Syensqo. The remaining essential chemicals business became the new Salve. The new Salve has 9,000 employees in over 40 countries globally. It has 7 major research and innovation centers and over 90 different branded products across 5 different business segments. In 2023, Salve had revenues of 4.9 billion euros and a 26% EBITDA margin. Salve is best known for soda ash, which makes up around 40% of sales. It has 4 other business segments, all of which have number one positions in their market. While these are all thought of as commodity businesses, they are higher margin and much more stable than most commodity chemical companies. All right, next chemistry joke. I know you all love compound interest. Today, we are interested in compounds. There are a few basic facts about soda ash, or sodium carbonate, that I will share with you. Salve's soda ash and derivatives business segment is diversified. 20% is used for flat glass applications. 15% is used in container glass. 10% is used in detergents and cleaning agents. And 30% is used in industrial applications to produce sodium silicates and lithium carbonate for EV batteries. Finally, a quarter of this segment is not soda ash, but a derivative called bicar, which is sodium bicarbonate. It's used in highly value-added pharmaceutical-grade food applications. Bicar can sell for much more than soda ash, particularly for pharmaceutical grade, and its market is growing twice as fast. Soda ash is quite an essential and versatile commodity chemical. The cartoon says it's a great all-purpose cleaner, and it makes nice flavoring for gum. That's actually true. Soda ash can be produced naturally or synthetically. Natural production, which is around 30% of the market, comes from mining and purifying trona ore. The problem is that trona is found in remote locations like Mongolia and Turkey and Wyoming, which individually accounts for over 80% of the global reserves. Like most of us, before this, I thought Wyoming was mostly for skiing and rodeos. Who knew? Synthetic production, which is around 70% of the market, is more expensive, uses ammonia, and consumes 2 to 3 times more energy. Salve today is 43% natural production and 57% synthetic production. Next chemistry cartoon to make sure you haven't fallen asleep, although there's no shame if you're fighting it after lunch. The cartoon says, wait, wait, before you mix them,
that
you have
was
to say,
David Einhorn at the Sohn Conference talking about the death of value investing in his pick, which is a European company called Salve. We're going to hear much more from David Einhorn and this pick when he sits down with our own Scott Wapner from the Sohn Conference. That's coming up at 2:15 p.m. Don't miss it. Let's bring back Nancy Tangler on the markets. Nancy, I'm not going to ask you about his pick in particular, but he was kind of poking fun here at growth investment and all the hype that we're seeing around artificial intelligence, valuations that got out of hand, and essentially talking about commodities. Where are you in the markets? Obviously, this week, we've seen the tech trade take a little bit of a breather and things like commodities continue to move higher.
Yeah, well, hopefully we're positioned well for all of that. We are value investors. I would say we're relative value investors, and that's kept us alive and allowed us to outperform pretty materially relative to the peer group. So you do have to be nimble in this business, but we also have a clean energy infrastructure strategy that's long on many of the commodities that have perked up this year. So I think as investors, you have to look at the sort of secular environment that you have been given and the narrative behind that. So I don't necessarily disagree that there is some AI hype, but I do believe it's real and it's driving productivity faster than many thought. Use cases are exploding. So we're focused on old economy companies that are embracing digitization and generative AI, and then the suppliers of the picks and shovels.
What are some of those old economy companies? This morning I was talking on another hour about AT&T using generative AI to upgrade legacy software code. Is that the kind of thing that you're looking at?
Yeah, like American Express using it for fraud detection, and their it has improved 6% just since they began. Medtronic using generative AI in product development for diabetes and heart. Walmart is a classic example of a company that's embracing all the technologies, robotics, digitization, generative AI in their ad business. They just raised the dividend 9%. We haven't seen that in a very long time. It reflects their confidence in the company's future earnings growth prospects. So those are some of the kinds of things we're looking at. Xylem, a water treatment company that is controlling much of their manufacturing and repair work on water systems digitally. So there's a lot of opportunities.
Nancy, on the flip side of that, I know you're an investor in Tesla. It's been a very rough few months for the company. Where are you on that name?
Yeah, Deirdre, I think some of it disappointed to some extent, but also I think we're very optimistic for the long term. It matters where you got in. We bought in last time the stock got pummeled around $104 a share in January. We sold some when it hit 250, and then we bought some back a little too early around 180 just a few weeks or months ago. And we will add to it if it continues to decline. I'm surprised it's not down more, but our focus is on the other businesses as well. And the stock does not trade on that at the moment. Look at the mega battery business. It's probably going to dwarf cars or EVs in the future. And it is, they are the low-cost producer with 15% market share in a total addressable market of $600 billion. So we think that's a really interesting part of the business. It's fastest growing, most profitable business at Tesla.
Nancy, thanks for your insights. Tesla getting a little bit of respite today, up 0.6%. Thank you. Still ahead on the show, we've got Slack, snacks, and software. We've got the trade on Levi's, Conagra, and BlackBerry ahead of earnings. That's next.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Welcome back. Believe it or not, it's that time. Earnings season is ramping up yet again. Levi Strauss, Conagra Brands, BlackBerry, they all have results on deck. Let's get to the trades ahead of the print in earnings exchange and bring in Delano Sapporo, New Street Advisors founder and CEO and a CNBC contributor. Starting off with Levi. Shares hitting a 52-week high on Monday. Consumer demand in focus as UBS notes the company has retaken the top market share spot in both men's and women's jeans. The firm, though, also tempering expectations due to increased promotions in the first quarter. Delano, you don't love Levi here, do you?
Yeah, I don't. I'm looking at the trends, and the trends, as the company mentioned last year, weren't great. And a lot of that is the consumer, and they did a little bit to combat and offset it with the price lowerings and reductions, but it wasn't enough. And I think one thing that I think that could be a positive is growing the direct-to-consumer channel, which they're working hard to do to improve margins, because if you look at what's going on with sales now and how the price reductions could hamper margins, that could be a negative effect on the company. So I think those are things that are interesting. And also looking at the consumer last year, it was interesting to note the value-based brands weren't doing as well. So that speaks a lot of what's going on with the consumer and a lot of how it's affecting the company going forward, Deirdre.
Well, don't miss Courtney Regan's exclusive interview with Levi Strauss CEO Michelle Gass in her first broadcast interview since assuming that role. That's tonight on Last Call. Next up, we've got Conagra Brands down more than 20% this year. Deutsche Bank says sales volumes remain under pressure. They're expecting gross margin declines as inflation lingers. Delano, you see some opportunity here?
Yeah, it would be a buy or hold for me. So there are obviously some things for the company that are struggling. And I think one of the things that I thought is strong for the company is you look at the reported 6% volume, the benefit for the brands that was consistent, beat earnings consistently. And those projections for earnings have been pretty tough. But on the flip side, you do have inflation continued. You do have, as we mentioned with Levi, a consumer that is struggling. So I think if you look at the groceries and snack side of the brand, that brand has actually consistently done well. And I think that holds here. I also think geographically, they have some things that are benefit for them. International sales were strong. So I look at the value here, talking about value investing, I look at the value with Conagra, and I think there's strong value for investors here.
Finally, let's talk BlackBerry. The phone turned software company down nearly 40% in a year. RBC attributing this to the EV slowdown where BlackBerry provides software as part of its Internet of Things offerings. Cybersecurity revenues also expected to be weak atop lower enterprise demand. Delano, how would you trade this name?
Right, Deirdre, this was interesting. The business has a lot of room for improvement, and they know that. That's why they're doing a lot of shakeup with management. And they're separating the businesses, as you mentioned, the Internet of Things, cybersecurity, so that can be enhanced focused for the two business segments. So I think it's also a growth story, and it's a story where they have relative value here. So if you look at what they're doing to cut expenses, that could potentially revert to profitability in a year or so, which is what they're around, what they're projecting, that they're making progress towards that. I don't think they're invested in a bargain hunting. This is a company that's trading at a little bit over 3x price to sales. It has a lot of growth prospects, as well as that relative value for investors. So I think it's one that people could look, keep on their watch list, mm-hmm. and potentially take a little bit of opportunity on.
Delano, thank you very much. Delano Saporo, New Street Advisors. The market's pricing in 3 Fed rate hikes, cuts this year. One stock picker says that'll be just fine to achieve a soft landing. The names that he's buying now, that's up next. Breaking news on Paramount. Alex Sherman is back with the story. What's the latest, Alex?
So the Wall Street Journal advancing their reporting from the New York Times a day ago, now saying that Paramount Global has actually entered exclusive talks with Skydance Media. This is David Ellison's media and entertainment company. These two parties have now been reported for, I would say, almost 6 months now as sort of dancing around each other. So no surprise that there's interest from Skydance in doing a potential merger with Paramount. The advancement is the exclusivity of those talks, which suggests that Paramount has now at least lasered in on a potential partner. We know that Apollo had bid $11 billion for the studio. Warner Brothers Discovery had been interested in preliminary talks with Paramount. I reported about a month ago that those talks broke down. So this has always been the most interested, logical buyer. The question is, how will this deal be structured? Paramount or Skydance Media has wanted to do sort of a two-step deal, where first they acquired National Amusements and then potentially merged in the film studio with the Paramount studio. But the Paramount board had always pushed back on that, saying, hey, look, we're only interested if you guys buy the whole thing. So you need to come up with excess capital if you want to do this deal for all of us. So that's what we still don't know. What is the structure of this deal going to look like? And will there be enough of a premium paid so that Paramount Global shareholders are okay with it?
And that was that sort of the deciding factor, Alex, that they'd rather sell the company as a whole. Apollo, you mentioned, for example, was just looking for the movie studio. By the way, we did reach out to Paramount. They issued a no comment.
Yeah. So look, I think we have known that there was heavy interest from the Skydance side. Skydance, by the way, backed by several private equity firms, KKR, Redbird. Redbird has some old media executives that now work for it. Jeff Zucker, Jeff Shell, who used to run our parent company, NBC Universal. So theoretically, if those guys got involved here, maybe even one of them could take on some sort of leadership role operationally within Paramount to some degree. At least those things have been floated out there as people have speculated about what a deal like this might look like if it gets done.
Yeah.
We're obviously still not to the finish line yet, but at least we can, with exclusive talks, we can say, okay, this may be the buyer of choice for Paramount. Now let's see the structure of the deal and if the shareholders will be happy with one.
What about the price of it? Any indication there? We know that Apollo submitted an $11 billion offer, right, for the movie studio alone. What are we looking at here?
So no indication yet on what the price is, but I do think that that's going to be the determining factor here. You know, look, Paramount Global has said, we have great assets. They're undervalued in the public market. Investors have sort of turned away from the broader legacy media space because of all the losses associated with streaming. But Paramount Pictures is valuable. And look, Apollo just priced Paramount Pictures at $11 billion. That doesn't even count the value of CBS,
right,
or the streaming assets or everything else that Paramount owns. So I do think price is going to be a major factor, and it's going to be a big enough number if Paramount Global shareholders say, you know what, this is the bid that we want to go with. We won't even look at anything else down the road.
Right. And I know that there's a lot that still has to happen, but let's say that it does move forward and Skydance acquires Paramount. What do you think it does with the company?
Right. Great question. So you'd have to think that it probably doesn't run the company as it's being run for the past several years. So the next step would probably be looking for divestitures. You know, one thing that I've reported in the past is that when Starz and Lionsgate, when that transaction actually happens and those two entities trade separately, Starz would potentially be looking for linear cable networks to bulk up. So maybe they become a buyer here and start picking off some of these Paramount Global networks. Private equity firms might be interested in doing it. But the interesting thing with this transaction, if that does happen, it may finally be the gateway that the media industry has been looking for years to sort of have a reconfiguration of legacy media.
These are all great points that you bring up. We're hitting up the end of the show. So we're going to do it for The Exchange now. Thank you, Alex Sherman. I'll join Tyler Matheson for Power Lunch on the other side of this quick break.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.